Chapter 3. I returned home for the long vacation without plans and without money. To cover end-of-term expenses, I had sold my Amiga screen to Collins for £10, of which I now kept 4. My last cheque overdrew my account by a few shillings, and I had been told that without my father's authority I must draw no more. My next allowance was not due until October. I was thus faced with a bleak prospect and, turning the matter over in my mind, I felt something not far off remorse for the prodigality of the preceding weeks. I had started the term with my battels paid and over £100 in hand. All that had gone, and not a penny paid out where I could get credit. There had been no reason for it, no great pleasure unattainable else. It had gone in ducks and drakes. Sebastian used to tease me, "You spend money like a bookie." But all of it went on him and with him. His own finances were perpetually, vaguely distressed. "It's all done by lawyers," he said helplessly, "and I suppose they embezzle a lot. Anyway, I never seem to get much. Of course, Mummy would give me anything I asked for." "Then why don't you ask her for a proper allowance?" "Oh, Mummy likes everything to be a present. She's so sweet," he said, adding one more line to the picture I was forming of her. Now Sebastian had disappeared into that other life of his where I was not asked to follow, and I was left, instead, forlorn and regretful. How ungenerously in later life we disclaim the virtuous moods of our youth, living in retrospect long summer days of unreflecting dissipation. There is no candour in a story of early manhood which leaves out of account the homesickness for nursery morality, the regrets and resolutions of amendment, the black hours which, like zero on the roulette table, turn up with roughly calculable regularity. Thus I spent the first afternoon at home, wandering from room to room, looking from the plate-glass windows in turn on the garden and the street, in a mood of vehement self-reproach. My father, I knew, was in the house, but his library was inviolable, and it was not until just before dinner that he appeared to greet me. He was then in his late 50s, but it was his idiosyncrasy to seem much older than his years. To see him, one might have put him at 70, to hear him speak at nearly 80. He came to me now, with the shuffling Mandarin tread which he affected, and a shy smile of welcome. When he dined at home, and he seldom dined elsewhere, he wore a frogged velvet smoking suit of the kind which had been fashionable many years before, and was to be so again, but at that time was a deliberate archaism. "My dear boy, they never told me you were here. Did you have a very exhausting journey? They gave you tea? You are well? I have just made a somewhat audacious purchase from Sonnenschein's, a terracotta bull of the 5th century. I was examining it and forgot your arrival. Was the carriage very full? You had a corner seat?" He travelled so rarely himself that to hear of others doing so always excited his solicitude. "Hayter brought you the evening paper? There's no news, of course. Such a lot of nonsense." Dinner was announced. My father, from long habit, took a book with him to the table, and then, remembering my presence, furtively dropped it under his chair. "What do you like to drink? Hayter, what have we for Mr. Charles to drink?"
"There's some whisky."
"There's whisky. Perhaps you like something else. What else have we?"
"There isn't anything else in the house, sir."
"There's nothing else. You must tell Hayter what you would like, and he will get it in. I never keep any wine now. I am forbidden it, and no one comes to see me. But while you are here, you must have what you like. You are here for long?"
"I'm not quite sure, Father. It's a very long vacation," he said wistfully.
"In my day, we used to go on what were called reading parties, always in mountainous areas. Why, he repeated petulantly, "should Alpine scenery be thought conducive to study?" "I had thought of putting in some time at an art school, in the life class."
"My dear boy, you'll find them all shut. The students go to Barbizon or such places and paint in the open air. There was an institution in my day called a sketching club. Mixed sexes, snuffle. Bicycles, snuffle. Pepper and salt knickerbockers, Holland umbrellas, and, it was popularly thought, free love, snuffle. Such a lot of nonsense. I expect they still go on. You might try that."
"One of the problems of the vacation is money, Father."
"Oh, I shouldn't worry about a thing like that at your age."
"You see, I've run rather short."
"Yes?" said my father, without any sound of interest.
"In fact, I don't quite know how I'm going to get through the next 2 months."
"Well, I'm the worst person to come to for advice. I've never been short, as you so painfully call it. And yes, what else could you say? Hard up? Penurious? Distressed? Embarrassed? Stony Brook, Snuffle. On the Rocks, in Queer Street. Let us say you are in Queer Street and leave it at that. Your grandfather once said to me, live within your means, but if you do get into difficulties, come to me. Don't go to the Jews. Such a lot of nonsense. You try. Go to those gentlemen on Jermyn Street who offer advances on note of hand only. My dear boy, they won't give you a sovereign. Then what do you suggest my doing? Your cousin Melchior was imprudent with his investments and got into a very queer street. He went to Australia. I had not seen my father so gleeful since he found 2 pages of 2nd-century papyrus between the leaves of a Lombardic breviary. Hater, I've dropped my book. It was recovered for him from under his feet and propped against the epergne. For the rest of dinner he was silent, save for an occasional snuffle of merriment which could not, I thought, be provoked by the work he read. Presently we left the table and sat in the garden room, and there, plainly, he put me out of his mind. His thoughts, I knew, were far away, in those distant ages where he moved at ease, where time passed in centuries and all the figures were defaced, and the names of his companions were corrupt readings of words of quite another meaning. He sat in an attitude which to anyone else would have been one of extreme discomfort, askew in his upright armchair, with his book held high and obliquely to the light. Now and then he took a gold pencil case from his watch chain and made an entry in the margin. The windows were open to the summer night, the ticking of the clocks, the distant murmur of traffic on the Bayswater Road, and my father's regular turning of the pages were the only sounds. I had thought it impolitic to smoke a cigar while pleading poverty. Now, in desperation, I went to my room and fetched one. My father did not look up. I pierced it, lit it, and with renewed confidence said, "Father, you surely don't want me to spend the whole vacation here with you, eh? Wouldn't you find it rather a bore having me at home for so long?" "I trust I should not betray such an emotion, even if I felt it," said my father mildly, and turned back to his book. The evening passed. Eventually, all over the room, clocks of diverse pattern musically chimed 11. My father closed his book and removed his spectacles. "You're very welcome, my dear boy," he said. "Stay as long as you find it convenient." At the door, he paused and turned back. "Your cousin Melchior worked his passage to Australia before the mast," Snuffle. "What, I wonder, is before the mast?" During that sultry week that followed, my relations with my father deteriorated sharply. I saw little of him during the day. He spent hours on end in the library. Now and then he emerged, and I would hear him calling over the banisters, "Hater, get me a cab." Then he would be away, sometimes for half an hour or less, sometimes for a whole day. His errands were never explained. Often I saw trays going up to him at odd hours, laden with meagre nursery snacks, rusks, glasses of milk, bananas, and so forth. If we met in a passage or on the stairs, he would look at me vacantly and say, "Ha-ha," or "Very warm," or "Splendid, splendid." But in the evening, when he came to the garden room in his velvet smoking suit, he always greeted me formally. The dinner table was our battlefield. On the second evening, I took my book with me to the dining room. His mind and wandering eye fastened on it with a sudden attention, and as we passed through the hall, he surreptitiously left his own on a side table. When we sat down, he said plaintively, "I do think, Charles, you might talk to me. I've had a very exhausting day. I was looking forward to a little conversation." "Of course, Father. What shall we talk about?" "Cheer me up, take me out of myself," petulantly. "Tell me all about the new plays." "But I haven't been to any." "You should, you know, you really should. It's not natural in a young man to spend all his evenings at home." "Well, Father, as I told you, I haven't much money to spare for theatre going." "My dear boy, you must not let money become your master in this way. Why, at your age, your cousin Melchior was part owner of a musical piece. It was one of his few happy ventures. You should go to the play as part of your education. If you read the lives of eminent men, you will find that quite half of them made their first acquaintance with drama from the gallery. I am told there is no pleasure like it. It is there that you find the real critics and devotees. It is called sitting with the gods. The expense is nugatory, and even while you wait for admission in the street, you are diverted by buskers. We will sit with the gods together one night. How do you find Mrs. Abel's cooking?" "Unchanged." "It was inspired by your Aunt Philippa. She gave Mrs. Abel 10 menus, and they have never been varied. When I am alone, I do not notice what I eat. But now that you are here, we must have a change. What would you like? What is in season? Are you fond of lobsters? Hater, tell Mrs. Abel to give us lobsters tomorrow night. Dinner that evening consisted of a white, tasteless soup, overfried fillets of sole with a pink sauce, lamb cutlets propped against a cone of mashed potato, stewed pears in jelly standing on a kind of sponge cake. It is purely out of respect for your Aunt Philippa that I dine at this length. She laid it down that a three-course dinner was middle class. If you once let the servants get their way, she said, you will find yourself dining nightly off a single chop. There is nothing I should like more. In fact, that is exactly what I do when I go to my club on Mrs. Abel's evening out. But your aunt ordained that at home I must have soup and three courses. Some nights it is fish, meat, and savoury. On others it is meat, sweet, savoury. There are a number of possible permutations. It is remarkable how some people are able to put their opinions in lapidary form. Your aunt had that gift. It is odd to think that she and I once dined together nightly, just as you and I do, my boy. Now she made unremitting efforts to take me out of myself. She used to tell me about her reading. It was in her mind to make a home with me, you know. She thought I should get into funny ways if I was left on my own. Perhaps I have got into funny ways, have I? But it didn't do. I got her out in the end. There was an unmistakable note of menace in his voice as he said this. It was largely by reason of my Aunt Philippa that I now found myself such a stranger in my father's house. After my mother's death, she came to live with my father and me, no doubt, as he said, with the idea of making her home with us. I knew nothing then of the nightly agonies at the dinner table. My aunt made herself my companion, and I accepted her without question. That was for a year. The first change was that she reopened her house in Surrey, which she had meant to sell, and lived there during my school terms, coming to London only for a few days' shopping and entertainment. In the summer, we went to lodgings together at the seaside. Then, in my last year in school, she left England. I got her out in the end, he said, with derision and triumph of that kindly lady, and he knew that I heard in the words a challenge to myself. As we left the dining room, my father said, Hater, have you yet said anything to Mrs. Abel about the lobsters I ordered for tomorrow? No, sir. Do not do so. Very good, sir. And when we reached our chairs in the garden room, he said, I wonder whether Hayter had any intention of mentioning lobsters. I rather think not. Do you know? I believe he thought I was joking. Next day, by chance, a weapon came to hand. I met an old acquaintance of school days, a contemporary of mine named Jorkins. I had never had much liking for Jorkins. Once, in my Aunt Philippa's day, he had come to tea, and she had condemned him as being probably charming at heart, but unattractive at first sight. Now I greeted him with enthusiasm and asked him to dinner. He came, and showed little alteration. My father must have been warned by Hayter that there was a guest, for instead of his velvet suit, he wore a tailcoat. This, with a black waistcoat, very high collar, and very narrow white tie, was his evening dress. He wore it with an air of melancholy, as though it were court mourning, which he had assumed in early youth, and, finding the style sympathetic, had retained. He never possessed a dinner jacket. "Good evening, good evening. So nice of you to come all this way." "Oh, it wasn't far," said Jorkins, who lived in Sussex Square. "Science annihilates distance," said my father disconcertingly. "You are over here on business?" "Well, I'm in business, if that's what you mean." "I had a cousin who was in business. You wouldn't know him. It was before your time. I was telling Charles about him only the other night. He has been much in my mind. He came," my father paused to give full weight to the bizarre word, "a cropper." Jorkins giggled nervously. My father fixed him with a look of reproach. "You find his misfortune the subject of mirth? Or perhaps the word I used was unfamiliar. You, no doubt, would say that he folded up." My father was master of the situation. He had made a little fantasy for himself that Jorkins should be an American, and throughout the evening he played a delicate one-sided parlour game with him, explaining any peculiarly English terms that occurred in the conversation, translating pounds into dollars, and courteously deferring to him with such phrases as, "Of course, by your standards." All this must seem very parochial to Mr. Jorkins. In the vast spaces to which you are accustomed, so that my guest was left with a vague sense that there was a misconception somewhere as to his identity, which he never got the chance of explaining. Again and again during dinner he sought my father's eye, thinking to read there the simple statement that this form of address was an elaborate joke, but met instead a look of such mild benignity that he was left baffled. Once I thought my father had gone too far when he said, "I am afraid that, living in London, you must sadly miss your national game." "My national game?" asked Jawkins, slow in the uptake, but scenting that here at last was the opportunity for clearing the matter up. My father glanced from him to me, and his expression changed from kindness to malice, then back to kindness again, as he turned once more to Jawkins. It was the look of a gambler who lays down fours against a full house. "Your national game," he said gently. "Cricket." And he snuffled uncontrollably, shaking all over and wiping his eyes with his napkin. "Surely, working in the city, you find your time on the cricket field greatly curtailed." At the door of the dining room he left us. "Good night, Mr. Jawkins," he said. "I hope you will pay us another visit when you next cross the herring pond." "I say, what did your governor mean by that? He seemed almost to think I was an American." "He's rather odd at times. I mean, all that about advising me to visit Westminster Abbey seemed rum." "Yes, I can't quite explain." "I almost thought he was pulling my leg," said Jawkins in puzzled tones. My father's counter-attack was delivered a few days later. He sought me out and said, "Mr. Jawkins is still here?" "No, father, of course not. He only came to dinner." "Oh, I hoped he was staying with us. Such a versatile young man. But you will be dining in?" "Yes. I'm giving a little dinner party to diversify the rather monotonous series of your evenings at home. You think Mrs. Abel is up to it? No, but our guests are not exacting. Sir Cuthbert and Lady Orme Herrick are what might be called the nucleus. I hope for a little music afterwards. I have included in the invitation some young people for you." My presentiments of my father's plan were surpassed by the actuality. As the guests assembled in the room which my father, without self-consciousness, called the gallery, it was plain to me that they had been carefully chosen for my discomfort. The young people were Miss Gloria Orme Herrick, a student of the cello, her fiancé, a bald young man from the British Museum, and a monoglot Munich publisher. I saw my father snuffling at me from behind a case of ceramics as he stood with them. That evening he wore, like a chivalric badge of battle, a small red rose in his buttonhole. Dinner was long, and chosen, like the guests, in a spirit of careful mockery. It was not of Aunt Philippa's choosing, but had been reconstructed from a much earlier period, long before he was of an age to dine downstairs. The dishes were ornamental in appearance and regularly alternated in colour between red and white. They and the wine were equally tasteless. After dinner my father led the German publisher to the piano, and then, while he played, left the drawing-room to show Sir Cuthbert Orme Herrick the Etruscan bull in the gallery. It was a gruesome evening, and I was astonished to find, when at last the party broke up, that it was only a few minutes after 11. My father helped himself to a glass of barley water and said, "What very dull friends I have! You know, without the spur of your presence, I should never have roused myself to invite them. I have been very negligent about entertaining lately. Now that you are paying me such a long visit, I will have many such evenings. You liked Miss Gloria Orme Herrick?"
"No."
"No? Was it her little moustache you objected to, or her very large feet? Do you think she enjoyed herself?"
"No."
"That was my impression also. I doubt if any of our guests will count this as one of their happiest evenings. That young foreigner played atrociously, I thought. Where can I have met him? And Miss Constantia Smethwick, where can I have met her? But the obligations of hospitality must be observed. As long as you are here, you shall not be dull." Strife was internecine during the next fortnight, but I suffered the more, for my father had greater reserves to draw on and a wider territory for manoeuvre, while I was pinned to my bridgehead between the uplands and the sea. He never declared his war aims, and I do not to this day know whether they were purely punitive, whether he had really at the back of his mind some geopolitical idea of getting me out of the country, as my Aunt Philippa had been driven to Bordighera, and Cousin Melchior to Darwin, or whether, as seems most likely, he fought for the sheer love of battle, in which indeed he shone. I received one letter from Sebastian, a conspicuous object which was brought to me in my father's presence one day when he was lunching at home. I saw him look curiously at it and bore it away to read in solitude. It was written on and enveloped in heavy late Victorian morning paper, black coroneted and black bordered. I read it eagerly.
Brideshead Castle, Wiltshire. I wonder what the date is. Dearest Charles, I found a box of this paper at the back of the bureau, so I must write to you as I am in mourning for my lost innocence. It never looked like living. The doctors despaired of it from the start. Soon I am off to Venice to stay with my papa in his palace of sin. I wish you were coming. I wish you were here. I am never quite alone. Members of my family keep turning up and collecting luggage and going away again, but the white raspberries are ripe. I have a good mind not to take Aloysius to Venice. I don't want him to meet a lot of horrid Italian bears and pick up bad habits. Love, or what you will, S. I knew his letters of old. I had had them at Ravenna. I should not have been disappointed. But that day, as I tore the stiff sheet across and let it fall into the basket, and gazed resentfully across the grimy gardens and irregular backs of Bayswater, at the jumble of soil pipes and fire escapes and protuberant little conservatories, I saw, in my mind's eye, the pale face of Anthony Blanche, peering through the straggling leaves as it had peered through the candle flames at Thame, and heard, above the murmur of traffic, his clear tones. You mustn't blame Sebastian if at times he seems a little insipid. When I hear him talk, I am reminded of that in some ways nauseating picture of Bubbles. For days after that, I thought I hated Sebastian. Then, one Sunday afternoon, a telegram came from him, which dispelled that shadow, adding a new and darker one of its own. My father was out and returned to find me in a condition of feverish anxiety. He stood in the hall with his Panama hat still on his head and beamed at me. You'll never guess how I have spent the day. I have been to the zoo. It was most agreeable. The animals seemed to enjoy the sunshine so much. Father, I've got to leave at once. Yes? A great friend of mine. He's had a terrible accident. I must go to him at once. Hayter's packing for me now. There's a train in half an hour. I showed him the telegram, which read simply, Gravely injured. Come at once, Sebastian. Well, said my father, I'm sorry you're upset. Reading this message, I should not say that the accident was as serious as you seem to think. Otherwise, it would hardly be signed by the victim himself. Still, of course, he may well be fully conscious but blind or paralysed with a broken back. Why exactly is your presence so necessary? You have no medical knowledge. You are not in holy orders. Do you hope for a legacy? I told you he's a great friend. Well, Orme Herrick is a great friend of mine, but I should not go tearing off to his deathbed on a warm Sunday afternoon. I should doubt whether Lady Orme Herrick would welcome me. However, I see you have no such doubts. I shall miss you, my dear boy, but do not hurry back on my account. Paddington Station, on that August Sunday evening, with the sun streaming through the obscure panes of its roof, the bookstalls shut, and the few passengers strolling unhurried beside their porters, would have soothed a mind less agitated than mine. The train was nearly empty. I had my suitcase put in the corner of a third-class carriage and took a seat in the dining car. First dinner after Reading, sir, about 7 o'clock. Can I get you anything now? I ordered gin and vermouth. It was brought up to me as we pulled out of the station. The knives and forks set up their regular jingle. The bright landscape rolled past the windows. But I had no mind for these smooth things. Instead, fear worked like yeast in my thoughts, and the fermentation brought to the surface, in great gobs of scum, the images of disaster. A loaded gun held carelessly at a stile, a horse rearing and rolling over, a shaded pool with a submerged stake, an elm bough falling suddenly on a still morning, a car at a blind corner. All the catalogue of threats to civilised life rose and haunted me. I even pictured a homicidal maniac mouthing in the shadows, swinging a length of lead pipe. The cornfields and heavy woodland sped past, deep in the golden evening, and the throb of the wheels repeated monotonously in my ears. You've come too late. You've come too late. He's dead. He's dead. He's dead. I dined and changed trains to the local line, and in twilight came to Melstead Carbury, which was my destination. Bride said, sir, yes, Lady Julia's in the yard. She was sitting at the wheel of an open car. I recognised her at once. I could not have failed to do so. You're Mr. Ryder. Jump in. Her voice was Sebastian's, and his her way of speaking. How is he? Sebastian? Oh, he's fine. Have you had dinner? Well, I expect it was beastly. There's some more at home. Sebastian and I are alone, so we thought we'd wait for you. What happened to him? Didn't he say? I expect he thought you wouldn't come if you knew. He's cracked a bone in his ankle, so small that it hasn't a name, but they x-rayed it yesterday and told him to keep it up for a month. It's a great bore to him, putting out all his plans, but he's making the most enormous fuss. Everyone else has gone.
He tried to make me stay back with him. Well, I expect you know how maddeningly pathetic he can be. I almost gave in, and then I said, surely there must be someone you can get hold of. And he said everybody was away or busy, and anyway, no one else would do. But at last he agreed to try you, and I promised I'd stay if you failed him, so you can imagine how popular you are with me. I must say it's noble of you to come all this way at a moment's notice. But as she said it, I heard, or thought I heard, a tiny note of contempt in her voice that I should be so readily available. How did he do it? Believe it or not, playing croquet, he lost his temper and tripped over a hoop, not a very honourable scar. She so much resembled Sebastian that, sitting beside her in the gathering dusk, I was confused by the double illusion of familiarity and strangeness. Thus, looking through strong lenses, one may watch a man approaching from afar, study every detail of his face and clothes, believe one has only to put a hand out to touch him, marvel that he does not hear one, and look up as one moves, and then, seeing him with the naked eye, suddenly remember that one is to him a distant speck, doubtfully human. I knew her, and she did not know me. Her dark hair was scarcely longer than Sebastian's, and it blew back from her forehead as his did. Her eyes on the darkling road were his, but larger. Her painted mouth was less friendly to the world. She wore a bangle of charms on her wrist, and in her ears little gold rings. Her light coat revealed an inch or two of flowered silk. Skirts were short in those days, and her legs, stretched forward to the controls of the car, were spindly, as was also the fashion. Because her sex was the palpable difference between the familiar and the strange, it seemed to fill the space between us, so that I felt her to be especially female, as I had felt of no woman before. "I'm terrified of driving at this time of the evening," she said. "There doesn't seem anyone left at home who can drive a car. Sebastian and I are practically camping out here. I hope you haven't come expecting a pompous party." She leaned forward to the locker for a box of cigarettes. "No, thanks. Light one for me, will you?" It was the first time in my life that anyone had asked this of me, and as I took the cigarette from my lips and put it in hers, I caught a thin bat squeak of sexuality, inaudible to any but me. "Thanks. You've been here before. Nanny reported it. We both thought it was very odd of you not to stay to tea with me." That was Sebastian. "You seem to let him boss you about a good deal. You shouldn't. It's very bad for him." We had turned the corner of the drive now. The colour had died in the woods and sky, and the house seemed painted in grisé, save for the central golden square at the open doors. A man was waiting to take my luggage. "Here we are." She led me up the steps and into the hall, flung her coat on a marble table, and stooped to fondle a dog which came to greet her. I wouldn't put it past Sebastian to have started dinner. At that moment he appeared between the pillars at the further end, propelling himself in a wheelchair. He was in pyjamas and dressing gown, with one foot heavily bandaged. "Well, darling, I've collected your chum," she said, again with a barely perceptible note of contempt. "I thought you were dying," I said, conscious then, as I had been ever since I arrived, of the predominating emotion of vexation rather than of relief, that I had been bilked of my expectations of a grand tragedy. "I thought I was, too. The pain was excruciating. Julia, do you think if you asked him, Wilcox would give us champagne tonight?" "I hate champagne, and Mr. Ryder has had dinner." "Mr. Ryder! Mr. Ryder! Charles drinks champagne at all hours. Do you know, seeing this great swaddled foot of mine, I can't get it out of my mind that I have gout, and that gives me a craving for champagne." We dined in a room they called the Painted Parlour. It was a spacious octagon, later in design than the rest of the house. Its walls were adorned with wreathed medallions, and across its dome prim Pompeian figures stood in pastoral groups. They and the satin wood and ormolu furniture, the carpet, the hanging bronze candelabrum, the mirrors and sconces, were all a single composition, the design of one illustrious hand. "We usually eat here when we're alone," said Sebastian. "It's so cosy." While they dined, I ate a peach and told them of the war with my father. "He sounds a perfect poppet," said Julia. "And now I'm going to leave you boys." "Where are you off to?" "The nursery. I promised Nanny a last game of Halma." She kissed the top of Sebastian's head. I opened the door for her. "Good night, Mr. Ryder, and goodbye. I don't suppose we'll meet tomorrow. I'm leaving early. I can't tell you how grateful I am to you for relieving me at the sickbed." "My sister's very pompous tonight," said Sebastian, when she was gone. "I don't think she cares for me," I said. "I don't think she cares for anyone much. I love her. She's so like me."
"Do you? Is she?"
"In looks, I mean, and the way she talks. I wouldn't love anyone with a character like mine." When we had drunk our port, I walked beside Sebastian's chair through the pillared hall to the library, where we sat that night and nearly every night of the ensuing month. It lay on the side of the house that overlooked the lakes. The windows were open to the stars and the scented air, to the indigo and silver moonlit landscape of the valley and the sound of water falling in the fountain. "We'll have a heavenly time alone," said Sebastian, and when, next morning, while I was shaving, I saw from my bathroom window Julia, with luggage at her back, drive from the forecourt and disappear at the hill's crest, without a backward glance, I felt a sense of liberation and peace, such as I was to know years later when, after a night of unrest, the siren sounded the all clear.